are Radio Catskill.
From the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, walking from Manhattan to the Catskills on the long path. Intrigued by a trail marker he spotted upstate, a photographer set out to follow a meandering and little-known hiking route north from New York City. Contributor Tracy Gates speaks to Casey Kelbaugh about his 27-day journey and roughly 300 miles of walking on trails that stretch from Manhattan to the Catskill Mountains. And the founder and managing producer of NPR's Life Kit is the author of a new book, Party of One. We'll discuss her empowering message of being your own soulmate and navigating a world full of societal expectations. She'll share insights from her journey and advice for mental and emotional sides of single living in a world built for two. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The FBI says the suspect in a deadly incident in New Orleans is now dead. The man drove a pickup truck at high speed through a crowd on Bourbon Street during a New Year's celebration early this morning. Police say at least 10 people were killed and at least 35 injured. The police commissioner said it was intentional that the driver was hell-bent on creating the carnage and the damage that he did. Gulf States Newsroom's Drew Hawkins has more.
Eyewitnesses report seeing a white pickup truck accelerate and intentionally drive through the crowd before exchanging gunfire with police and speeding away.
I think we alone probably saw 5, 6, 7 bodies.
Jim Maurer and his wife were in town visiting for the celebrations. He says Bourbon Street was packed with revelers for New Year's Eve. They heard crashing sounds and turned to see the truck plowing through the crowd.
We were hoping to provide some first aid to the bodies we came across, but were very clearly deceased, and then we moved out of the area.
Police have not released information about suspects or motives at this time. For NPR News, I'm Drew Hawkins in New Orleans.
Funeral services for Jimmy Carter will be held in Georgia and in Washington beginning this weekend. He died Sunday at the age of 100. One of his legacies is bringing more women into cabinet-level positions. That includes the nation's first black woman to serve as a White House cabinet secretary. Molly Samuel from member station WABE reports.
In 1977, President Carter appointed Patricia Roberts Harris, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. In that role, she reorganized the department to focus more on neighborhood rehabilitation. She went on to another cabinet position when Carter later appointed her to lead the department that became Health and Human Services. Prior to Carter's appointment, Harris was the first African-American woman to serve as U.S. ambassador. President Lyndon Johnson appointed her as top diplomat to Luxembourg. Harris attended Howard University, where she later became the first woman dean of the law school. She earned a law degree from George Washington University. For NPR News, I'm Molly Samuel in Atlanta.
Russia launched a drone attack on Ukraine this New Year's Day, firing on the capital, Kyiv. Officials say an apartment building was hit and at least one civilian was killed. NPR's Brian Mann reports from Kyiv.
Ukraine is finding ways to punch back, and let me describe some of that. The Russian army, and this is important, appears to be losing more than 30,000 soldiers killed and wounded every month. Last summer, of course, Ukraine invaded Russia in a surprise move. They still occupy a chunk of the Kursk region. Last month, Ukraine's spy agency claimed credit for assassinating a top Russian general in Moscow, and Ukraine is launching frequent drone attacks of its own, striking industrial and military targets deep inside Russia.
This is NPR News in Washington. There's no end in sight to Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza. Health officials there say Israeli strikes today killed more than a dozen people, including children. In southern Israel, air raid sirens sounded at the stroke of midnight last night when Hamas fired 2 rockets across the border. There were no reports of injuries or damage. Valley fever cases are up 20% above last year's numbers in California. The disease can be fatal in the worst cases and is still rare enough that it's often misdiagnosed. NPR's Alejandra Burunda has more.
Valley fever is caused by inhaling spores of a particular fungus that lives in dirt and soil. When the dirt gets disturbed, the fungus can fly into the air where people can breathe it in. The disease was rare in California 20 years ago, but the fungus has spread and multiplied over that time, along with the number of cases. They've increased by a factor of 6 since the early 2000s, according to state health data. Scientists think the fungus's range is expanding because of climate change. It thrives in conditions like those the state has gone through in recent years, with extremely wet winters coming on the heels of extreme drought. Alejandra Borunda, NPR News.
One of the last remaining survivors of the attack on Pearl Harbor has died. His family says Harry Chandler died in Florida Monday. He was a Navy medic when waves of Japanese fighter planes dropped bombs and fired torpedoes at battleships in the harbor. Chandler helped the wounded. In a Pacific Historic Parks interview, he said, "It got so busy you weren't scared. It was after you got scared." Harry Chandler was 103. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing about the state of housing in America on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact, and the Doris Duke Foundation. Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Happy New Year. And on this first day of the new year, some folks across the country are celebrating by participating in a first day hike in one of America's state parks. These guided hikes are organized annually from Hawaii to Maine to encourage individuals and families to start the year on the right foot by getting outside and connecting with nature. The distance and rigor of the hikes vary from park to park. Photographer Casey Kelbaugh embarked on a slightly longer hike on the first day of summer 2024. He stepped out into the blistering heat from his New York City apartment building in Alphabet City and headed west on 4th Street, bound for his home in the Catskills. It was a 27-day, roughly 300-mile journey on the Long Path, a long-distance hiking trail. He wrote about his experience in the New York Times in September, and contributor Tracy Gates spoke to him about his hike on this little-known trail.
Where am I speaking to you from today?
I'm actually in my apartment in the East Village of Manhattan, specifically the Alphabet City part.
That's one of the places that you live, but your other home is where exactly?
It's in Edgewood, which is a hamlet in the town of Hunter of Greene County. It's now part of Lanesville, so it's a hamlet within a hamlet within a town. I'm sure some of you are familiar with those situations in your neck of the woods.
I'm so thrilled that you were able to talk to me and talk to our listeners today about your article that appeared in the New York Times titled Walking from Manhattan to the Catskills on the Long Path. Given that so many people shared it with me, I have a feeling that a number of listeners have already read it. But I'm just thinking, for those who haven't, could you read the first two paragraphs for us?
Sure. Just give me a second here. On the first day of summer, I stepped out into the blistering heat from my apartment building in Alphabet City and headed west on 4th Street, bound for my home in the Catskills, some 130 miles north. I carried a 35-pound backpack filled with camping gear and little idea of what lay ahead. I had learned about the route I was taking, called the Long Path, from a trail marker I'd seen behind my house in Edgewood, New York. Since then, I'd wondered if I could make use of it to trek between my two homes with only a handful of turns, north onto Broadway, west across the George Washington Bridge, and north again until I reached the Catskills.
Oh, my gosh. I have to say what I particularly notice is that how your directions sound so simple. Just take a couple turns and you'll be home.
Well, that was the allure, you know? I was sort of like intrigued by the simplicity of it. I just had bookmarked it in the back of my head to try to, when I found the time and the ability to try to do it, you know?
Yeah, I'm always interested in how people decide on kind of big adventures. And this was kind of a, would you say this was a big adventure?
I would definitely say it was a big adventure, yes. Yeah, so I'm from Seattle originally in the Northwest. And so I grew up camping and hiking and climbing and spent a lot of time in the woods through high school and college in Vermont, as well as lived in Glacier National Park for 2 summers, climbed a lot of those mountains. Just it's always been the outdoors, hiking, climbing, and such have always been a background, you know, but very important aspect of my life, and pretty much wherever I am living. So I've done, you know, multi-day overnight backpacking trips, always with others. I think the longest might have been in Glacier, maybe 8 nights or 7 nights. So this was by far the biggest undertaking I had ever attempted.
I actually had to look up, like probably many readers did, where exactly the long path was, because I thought there is a route or a path or a hiking trail all the way from New York City, you know, to the Catskills.
Almost to the Adirondacks.
Yes.
Even crazy.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
What's interesting is I don't remember when, but I think to kind of generate awareness about the trail, the trailhead was moved to the 175th Street MTA subway station in Washington Heights. Mm-hmm. So I was a bit underwhelmed when I arrived there and saw, and there was no trail marker, no plaque or anything. So I would really like to spearhead some kind of effort to get something there. In fact, I would love to have the first couple stanzas of the Walt Whitman poem, the long Song of the Open Road, there as, you know, just a point of inspiration, because I can just imagine, like, a, you know, kid growing up there, coming across that and, like, coming to understand that this, you know, you could walk all the way to the forever wilds, you know, of the Adirondack Mountains from where you're standing without without interruption. I mean, interruption, sure, but without, you know, there is a continuous sort of conduit. So, so it starts there, which is kind of bizarre, but really cool. And then I crossed the George Washington Bridge, which was, you know, an interesting experience in and of itself. I would see people doing so when I'm driving by. It was blazing hot. I don't know if I can emphasize enough that, you know, leaving on the first day of summer and walking through 3 successive back-to-back record-breaking heat waves with, like, humidity through the roof was very much my companion on the trail.
I'm so sorry. No, but,
yeah, no, I, and in many ways, I kind of, like, relished the challenge of it. But it did mean that I had to carry a great deal of water. I'm a heavy hydrator to begin with, and so I was, you know, constantly, I carried 4 liters of water, which is probably was a lot of my weight, but I was losing it so fast that, you know what I mean? I think it kind of evened out pretty quickly. But so, yes, I crossed the bridge, and then you kind of take a right straight up the Palisades, and then along the narrow strip between the Palisades Parkway and the escarpment. You know, there are times where, and I think it's illustrated in at least one photo, there's definitely more, where you're, I don't know, a dozen feet from the edge of the road or something. And you poke out, like, most of the time you're sort of below or hidden or behind shrubbery or grasses or, you know, trees. But once in a while you kind of peek out and you see these cars and they see you, and it just feels like 2 different universes colliding, you know?
Yes.
So that continues on for many miles. I thought it was very interesting because you come across, there's something like Allison Park, I think it's called, beautiful mansion. There's some out, you know, there's overlooks where you like come up on like all manner of humanity stopping and getting out of their car to take in the views across the Hudson. I also went down to the shore trail for parts of it, which were
along the Hudson River.
Yeah, which I'm told runs from Edgewater. So that was really lovely. And that's where I started to encounter more cyclists that were like, oh yeah, I just got here in 2 hours. And I'm like, well, it's my third day. So that was humbling. Mm. And I was actually kind of happy to get to the point where I was no longer meeting people that had, were just doing a little afternoon jaunt. Eventually it starts to hook westward a little bit around Hook Mountain, which is, I think, I don't know how you describe it, but it's a part of the Hudson where it kind of bulges out.
Okay.
You pass into back into New York State, and mm-hmm. again, you're sort of along the edge of the river mm-hmm. through a number of state parks, which I mentioned earlier in the story, mm-hmm. all very lovely in different ways with different offerings. You know, some mm-hmm. have public pools right off the trail, like mm-hmm. almost like an oasis.
Mm-hmm.
And others have like old, you know, remnants from World War I training and so mm-hmm. forth, like almost like, yeah, like barracks and, yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And great views, you know.
Mm.
I think still on the seventh day or so, I was still seeing the George Washington Bridge.
Oh my gosh.
When I looked back, at least somewhere around Stony Point, which was depressing, but mm-hmm. I continued on. And then you kind of, there's a awkward point around Mount Ivy where you have to take, you know, one of these sections where you're kind of along the road in between behind someone's yard and in between a train track. And mm-hmm. there's several of these sections, which I found pretty interesting, but could often, you know, they're just not super relaxing because you're crossing roads and so forth. But mm-hmm. you go north for a bit and it hooks then across Harriman State Park and up through kind of diagonally northwest through the park, which is a total joy and a wonderful, just a wonderful park. I hadn't really spent a lot of time there because I would usually just drive past it on the way to the Catskills. So there was a ton of trails and a lot of activity there. I was there over the weekend, so I did, in fact, see a lot of other hikers and so forth, Appalachian Trail hikers.
I was really struck by that one part in your story about those interactions that you had with the Appalachian Trail through hikers, because you described how they had this kind of weariness about them, probably because they've hiked, what, you know, a lot of miles by that point. But I guess what it was really intriguing to me is that these days, where a lot of people seem really fixated on, you know, doing something the fastest, what struck me about your trip and what I really appreciated about it is that you seemed to, I mean, you really took your time, and that seemed meaningful to you. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. No, I was really excited to, you know, to convene with these other thru hikers on the Appalachian Trail because I had no company whatsoever. And, you know, I thought it would be a great moment to kind of compare notes and so forth. And I was frankly somewhat disappointed by the lack of engagement, lack of interest. And everything felt sort of fixed in mm-hmm. advance.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of shrugged my shoulders and thought to myself, okay, well, whatever that is, I think the long path should be the opposite, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I already had set out to do this on my own terms without, I didn't reach out to editors or anyone in advance or have any, you know, specific project in mind. I really just wanted to experience it in the spirit of Walt Whitman's poem, which I could probably find the first couple stanzas if you wanted. Do you want to hear them?
Oh my gosh, if you have them pretty
close
to you, that would be great.
Okay, this is where the name The Long Path came from, right?
Mm.
Okay, Song of the Open Road by Walt Whitman. Afoot and lighthearted I take to the open road, healthy, free, the world before me, the long brown path before me, leading wherever I choose. Henceforth, I ask not good fortune, I myself am good fortune. Henceforth, I whimper no more, postpone no more, need nothing. Done with indoor complaints, libraries, querulous criticisms. Strong and content, I travel the open road.
Yeah, I'm assuming that you were familiar. You're pretty familiar with that poem before you started out, or were you?
Yeah. I mean, I still don't know it super well, but I like the spirit of it, and that was kind of the way I wanted to approach this thing. I was thinking I could probably do it in a month, but I had no idea. I really had no idea if I would be able to finish it. I had no idea. I was fairly concerned that I would get injured at some point, and that would take me out. Bringing trekking poles, which is, I keep them pretty close by when hiking these days, saved me up 1,000 times. I 100% would have twisted or broken my ankle during different sections dozens and dozens of times without them. I was also concerned about ticks. I think it was a low season for ticks. I had concerns that it wouldn't even, I may not be able to do it.
Yeah. Well, the weather sounded pretty miserable in sections, but I actually did have a couple of like practicality questions. Like, so where were you getting your food and water from along the way? I mean, obviously a lot of it is through civilization, but what did you do about that?
I carried sort of backpacker meals, which are like these freeze-dried meals that you can find in outdoor stores that have gotten a lot better over the years. So, you know, it might be like shrimp pad Thai or quinoa and black bean kind of adobo something. Or and you basically just boil about a cup or two of water, mix it in, and then wait 15 minutes. And I would eat with a spoon literally right out of the bag. I would also pick up stuff. There was, at least in the first, you know, two-thirds or more of the hike, there's not very many days where I wasn't passing through towns or crossing roads or, you know, I went to diners and had some lovely meals. If I was afforded the opportunity to eat a nice meal or take a shower or shave or, you know, wash my clothes, I absolutely took. This was not about deprivation, and you know, I tried to not, you know, appear as, you know, Rip Van Winkle or whatever when I walked into town. So food was, there was a lot of surprise. Like, you know, came across stuff that was really exciting. I ate my share of ice cream.
A good reason to do physical things. I'm with you on the ice cream part.
No, but on that note, I was amazed at like how weight just sort of fell off me. Like I think I lost 15 pounds, and you just, when you're walking whatever 6 to 12 hours a day in that kind of heat, it just.
Sorry to interrupt, but I was just also curious about. You said this wasn't a trip about deprivation. You did say that you were camping. Were you camping the whole time, or?
Gratefully had a number of friends along the way. I don't think I'd planned any of this in advance. I really had no idea what to expect. But I ended up staying 4 different times with friends along the way. And my best friend, I'm going to shout out Alex Ammerman, gave me, he kind of did support for me. He had my car with additional food and gear, so I could swap things out and also replenish my food. I think he met me twice, and so I would do like pick up like eight days of food and fuel and stuff. There was another thru-hiker that I found out about later who was being supported, and he was coming from north to south. He was doing the whole thing, right, from Thatcher State Park.
Oh, okay.
All the way to, and he took a 3-day break right at the time that I took a 1-day break. So we missed each other. But we learned about each other. I was hiking down a lonely stretch of Lundy Road, which is just north of Kerhonkson, kind of as you're getting up into the Catskills. Mm-hmm. And I was contemplating how very alone I was in the world. And mm-hmm. right then, a Subaru was passing in the other direction and slows and stops and says, and a guy leans over and says, "Are you? You're not walking the long path, are you?" And I'm like, "Yes, I am." Uh-huh. And he's like, "Oh, hey, my name's Andy Garrison. I'm the chairman of the whole thing, the long path committee."
Oh my gosh!
And I'm like, "What?" And I was like, "Can you pull over for a second?
Yeah,
I want to have some words with you."
Wow.
But yeah, he pulled over and we shot the, you know. And it was really great to learn more and get more perspective. And he was awesome. And he mm-hmm. alone is responsible for a great deal of trail maintenance. I mean, there's a whole army of people that have over many, many generations, but also, you know, today, on so many different levels, working to make this thing a better as good as it can be, including, you know, acquiring new tracts of land so they can move the trails off roads into the woods. Mm-hmm. It's a constant, you know, it's a living thing. This trail, and I'm sure all the others are in the same way. Mm. He mentioned that the Appalachian Trail had made all this over the years, had done everything to move outside of towns, you know, but they learned that people had to go to the towns anyway to get their food, you know, and resupply. So, so they're still running. This trail is runs through a bunch of towns, which I found both interesting and helpful.
We'll take a break and be back with more of Tracy's conversation with Casey Kelbaugh, the photographer who embarked on a long distance journey on the long path. More after this. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guest is Rachel Kushner. She's the author of books like The Mars Room and The Flamethrowers. She'll talk about her new novel. It's a take on noir called Creation Lake. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill. Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Let's return to contributor Tracy Gates and her conversation with photographer Casey Kelbaugh about his journey along the long path. Intrigued by a trail marker he spotted upstate, he set out to follow the meandering and little-known hiking route north from New York City and wrote about it in the New York Times.
At a certain point in your article, you talk about how, you know, you're kind of leaving the gravitational pull, I love how you put it, of New York City. Sure. And then everything gets, you know, more wild. Were you aware of how you felt in that change from the noise of suburbia to just things feeling more wild?
Yeah, I was ready for a change, we could put it that way. So that's when the trail leads you pretty much from the Hudson all the way to the Delaware, almost around Port Jervis.
Okay.
And that's when I, you know, you kind of jog left or northeast up along the Shawanagunk Ridge, if that's how it's pronounced. Mm-hmm. During that process going into Goblin's Knob, I think it's called, State Forest. And and then Sam's Point and, you know, through Wurtsboro and Bashakill. But you get up towards Minnewaska and so forth, and then beyond into the southern reaches of the Catskills, that's when it starts to feel, you just get a distinct sense that it's not a commuter, there's not a commuter culture as much. It's not as sort of like tethered to the city. And it was a welcome relief. I kind of felt myself relax a little bit, even though, yeah, I was still carrying the same amount of weight. there was a more, a wildness to it that I liked. Like, there was a few times I was desperate to try to go swimming every day if possible.
Oh, okay.
Because there was two plus day stretches where I couldn't like submerge my body in water, and I was getting into like my hammock or even sleeping bag or whatever. It was pretty rough. And so I would be Googling the river running nearby to see if it was toxic or not. You know what I mean?
Right, right, right.
And there was definitely one that I almost went in and then realized that it would have been a bad decision. The river is clean, the air pressure, and just a lot more. I mean, frankly, there was wildlife all along the way, but, you know, different things that you might not see. I mean, the songbirds, beginning in the Palisades all the way through, were just remarkable.
You mentioned at some point in the article how you really felt like you were the only one on the trail. I wasn't sure if that was an exaggeration or that
No.
felt pretty close to what it was like.
That was not an exaggeration. I was the only one on the trail. Like,
wow.
I guess Tom was walking in the opposite direction, but we didn't even see each other. So in so many cases, especially, midweek, like Harriman State Park on the weekends, sure, I saw a lot of people. Catskill Park on the weekends, Minnewaska on the weekend, sure. But they were doing day hikes, for the most part. And I did encounter a couple, overnight campers that would take the train up to the Tuxedo Park station and do backpacking in Harriman, which I thought was really cool and I hadn't considered before. But many, many days where I maybe saw one person. I mean, this is peak hiking season. Like, that's what surprised me the most.
Yeah.
Had it been October or April, but.
So I'm curious then, were you lonely at all? Were there points that you thought, okay, I'm ready for this to end or I wish I was on a more popular trail?
Once in a while, I would check in with old social media and I'd be like, why am I not on the Mediterranean with everyone else? But it also looked like a total mob scene, and it looked, I was completely confident in my decision. I frankly enjoyed every minute of it. I was having a blast. I was not lacking. When I needed to reach out to people, I could. There were certain moments for sure I may have felt a bit lonesome, I think that time is valuable as well. I think it was important. I needed to spend a lot of time with myself, and I've always enjoyed it. And it was many ways about reconnecting, with myself as much as the physicality of the space between my two homes,
You also mention in the article about how that not a day went by, amongst other things, that your assumptions weren't toppled. And I wasn't sure it was that assumptions about the long path itself or the people along the way or just
everything.
Everything. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I tend to do this when I travel. I don't do too much research in advance. I mean, I want to know where I'm going and make sure I have what I need and so forth. But, I'd be hiking along and all of a sudden I'd come, as I'm entering Harriman State Park, there's like a graveyard of old, beautiful, rusted out cars from the 50s and 40s, mixed in with rhododendron bushes going up this hillside. And just like there was phenomenal flora and fauna along the way that I just wasn't expecting to see. I was at the top of, I think it was Hook Mountain, and there was several stands of cacti. There's cactuses growing at the top of this mountain in New York State. That kind of blows my mind. I didn't know that that was a thing, mm-hmm, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There was interactions with different, you know, many different kinds of people and communities. Food I encountered and diners along the way, and Stony Point Diner, I want to call out. just various ideas that I had about people, places, and things, in advance were often dead wrong. The trail, what was a mile ahead of me, you know what I mean?
Mm.
Half a mile.
Yeah.
I was constantly surprised. And then that was what made it so exciting, and also, you know, having kind of an open mindset, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did you have goals for each day, or at least along the way?
Yeah, there's a few things like that were on my sort of vague radar, but I generally was unable to plan more than like 2 days in advance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I was trying to kind of meet up with Alex, who was providing support, mm-hmm. like I could give vague estimates, you know, where I might end up, but it just, there would be, you know, what looked like a flat stretch of, on the map would, you know, when you look closer, it was like ridge after ridge. And that would be really, that would slow me down greatly, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And also, if I found a sweet place to camp, that's where I was going to stay.
Mm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I 100% tried to make those experiences memorable. You know,
mm-hmm.
there was a few nights where I so quote unquote kind of bivouacked, like as a storm came in, or just because I was running out of places to be. But most of the time, I tried to kind of stop a couple hours before dark, or an hour before dark,
mm-hmm.
which was pretty late
mm-hmm.
in that time of year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And chill out for a bit.
Were you mostly camping in a, sleeping in a hammock? I mean, did you have a tent as well?
Yeah. So this is my first time trying hammock camping. I think it's fairly, it's a newer thing. And I liked it because I thought it would be easier to find two trees that are, you know, what, 10 or 15 feet apart than finding flat patches of ground where I can, you know, find a, whatever, 3x6 patch of flat ground. You know what I'm saying? And also mm-hmm. sort of being up above what I would thought was going to be just a, you know, like a tick festival.
yeah.
So trying to be, you know, up off the ground a little bit, but. And so I did. I found it was wonderful. I found it actually really comfortable. Not everyone can sleep in hammocks, because if you sleep on your face, I think forget it.
Yeah.
But I slept on my side and on my back really comfortably. I had an inflatable air mattress. I think because I was so exhausted physically,
sure.
I was able to sleep. There was like, I was getting 9 hours a night a lot of times, just almost straight through,
yeah.
which that doesn't really happen in the real world for me.
Yeah.
It was kind of blissful at times.
I'm also curious, were you aware of trying not to be as connected, I guess?
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was times where that was just taken away from me because there was no signal.
Okay.
But yeah, no, I was not up to the minute with everything and everyone and so forth. I was sort of internally oriented, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And did that feel? But, did that feel good?
Oh, it was great. Yeah, definitely. I wasn't such a purist. Like, I needed for navigation. I had, I think, 17 maps that were like sequential maps, like trail maps that the New Jersey, New York Trail Conference puts out. Mm-hmm. By the way, none of this would be possible without the New Jersey New York Trail Conference. Incredible organization.
Mm.
The most well-marked trail I've ever trodden. I mean,
really?
Really impressive from start to finish. I couldn't believe it. Really impressive work by their team and of all volunteers. But So not all the maps matched up. That section where I mentioned going along the rail trail, that was without maps, so I had to use all trails for that. I know there's other apps and other ways to do it, but I was kind of going between digital and paper, and I needed both in different times. I needed to have a power bank, and I had to occasionally power up my devices, or my device, really. I was never like living my 17th century life, you know?
yep.
But that wasn't what I was looking for either. That's not what was driving me.
I find that when I'm taking a trip by myself, my thinking kind of changes. It's, you know, the longer I'm out there for. Did you feel like your head was kind of changing a bit, or you were thinking about things differently along the way?
Definitely, yeah. There was numerous transformational aspects. I think I'm still processing them, you know? It was really nice to get to a point where I just felt so comfortable alone in the woods and outdoors in the middle of the night, and felt kind of at one and at peace with that, and not either feel fearful or, you know, I don't know, anxious. That was a really nice, as I mentioned, I spent a lot of time in the woods over the years, but this was very extended.
Just in speaking with you, I feel like, oh my gosh, there's so many more questions I could ask. This is kind of a classic question. If there's anything that you would have changed about would you have changed anything about the trip? If you could go back in time, was there something that you think you would have changed?
That's a great question. I didn't actually think of that. I don't know that I would change that much.
That's great.
Yeah, I was really happy with the amount of challenge it brought. I was floored by how hard it was. I don't know why I didn't think it would be. It's just the idea of walking a certain miles, a number of miles a day with a backpack on variable terrain. It just sounded like a very reasonable thing to me. But when you factor in the weight and the humidity and the unexpected elevation gain and the, I don't know, heat rash. I never really experienced heat rash before. That's no fun at all. Heat exhaustion, regular exhaustion. I don't know. There's just a lot that made it much harder than I expected. Obviously, you can temper that with how much distance you take on a day. But sure. I think I took it really slow in the beginning, and then I got nervous that I was going to be on the trail for the rest of 2024, and I sped up for like a week.
Yeah,
and I went really as fast as I could for like a week, or tried to gain ground, and then I realized that I was, you know, kind of could see the end in sight, or I was coming to familiar ground. I slowed back down a little bit, but kind of depends on where your head is at and what your restrictions are.
So you did end up aiming for about roughly a month. Was that what you were aiming for?
Yeah. I predicted about 28 days and ended up being a day shorter. Wow. My last day was actually the hardest. It was from Mount Tremper. I stayed in my friend's barn in Mount Tremper, and then climbed Mount Tremper, which is a pretty tough hike to begin with, and then walked that stretch of the long path that goes on this ridge over at Silver Hollow Mountain. There's a whole valley in between, actually, down Warner Creek, Silver Hollow Notch. And it's very wild back there. And I saw a bear on the trail. And I just felt like I was being watched by bears the whole time. I climbed Silver Hollow Mountain and Edgewood Mountain, which is kind of directly behind my house. And then I bushwhacked down from there in a early evening through some pretty gnarly, slippery terrain, and crossed my creek right behind my house.
Really?
And and took a dip, jumped in the hammock that I wasn't carrying that was already there.
Yeah.
And so it was engineered as I had hoped.
Yeah.
But it was not easy, especially that last day. It was actually really, really hard.
Yeah. How did you feel when you You got there, and it was over.
I was grateful.
We're going to have to bleep honestly, that, but anyway.
sorry. I was grateful. But I also, again, when I mentioned injury, coming down this bushwhack from the long path to my property on these slippery, wet rocks, I came so close to injury in the very last pitch.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, so I was pretty, I had everything. I had multiple layers on, tucked into multiple layers because of ticks, because I was going straight through, you know, woods. That, and so I was very hot and, you know, overheated and, yeah, I was pretty grateful to sink myself in Stony Clove Creek when I got there.
Well, Casey, thank you so much for spending so much time with me and our listeners today. I just found what we've talked about and also what you wrote and the pictures that you took, they're wonderful, and it's also inspiring. So I think there's going to be a few more people on the long path, but hopefully not as many as other places.
I think there's a lot of room for more people to join the long path. It's not anywhere close to being oversaturated. So that is not a concern of mine right now. But if it gets more people out, then wonderful.
Yeah.
I think it's a very underutilized resource that's been available to us for a long time. Thank you for taking the time as well.
And thanks to Tracy Gates for that report. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll speak to the creator of NPR's Life Kit about her new book, Party of One. This is Radio Chatskill.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Ina Garten, the barefoot Contessa, takes on some of your burning questions.
I always wonder whether a bay leaf makes a difference.
This is called Making News. Ina Garten calls BS on bay leaves. Ina Garten, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Listen Sunday at 6 for the New Yorker Radio Hour on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. For generations, we've been sold a singular story of happiness to find, quote, the one, live happily ever after. But what if there is no one? What if you're alone? When Megan Keane, the creator of NPR's Life Kit, found the dating process miserable, she set off to find fulfillment in being single. Her new book, Party of One, illustrated by L.A. Johnson, follows her voyage beyond the traditional path. With insights from marriage historians and rumination researchers, the ideas she gathers ease the relationship pressure on anyone, coupled, singled, or somewhere in between. I spoke with her in October.
So I wanted to write this book because after, you know, over a decade of singleness, I was really questioning to myself, I know it's wonderful and valid to be single, but I was still feeling a lot of shame and frustration and depression. And so I was really working to think, okay, how do I make a life that is filled with more ease and connect my head and my heart so I can actually not just know that it's good to be single, but really feel that it's good to be single too.
And you're the founder and producer of NPR's Life Kit. So you delve into a lot of these life issues. Did you ever think that the life issue would be you and your life issue?
Well, this book actually sprung from a Life Kit episode I did about 2 years ago. And my team was like, we should do this topic. And I was like, yeah, let's find someone to host it. And they're like, I think you should host it. And so I'm glad they did. I'm glad they pushed me. There's a saying that goes, you know, there's a lot of me search that happens with book writing, right? So I did a little me search, and I approached this book like I would a life kit, really, which is thinking, okay, I'm going to show some of my personality and some of my story about how I related to these ideas in the book, but then also find a lot of evidence-based tips about what does it mean to manage your emotions, to think through rumination, to build a community, to destigmatize singleness. So I definitely use my Life Kit skills to help write this book.
And you came to this conclusion that you could be your own soulmate. But as you said, you had to go through this process, and demystifying singleness is a big part of that process. And talk a little bit about the you know, why folks sort of have this idea of what singleness is, and maybe why there's a negative connotation to it in some ways.
Sure. So with singleness, there's often this unfair shame, right, that's put on it, that you're sad, you're lonely, you're pathetic if you don't just simply have a romantic partner. But if you think about it, it doesn't make a lot of sense, right, if you kind of delve into it even just for like a second more. And so I was trying to find ways to kind of deflate that argument around singleness. There's actually this term called singleism from researcher Bella DiPaolo, who says that singleism happens when we marginalize or discriminate against singles because there's such a premium put on marriage and partnership. Think about how much of our economy, right, is based around partnership, our tax code as well. So, and also just socially, what it means to show up to a place with another person. So there's a lot of emphasis in our culture placed on what does it mean to be partnered. So as a result, if you're not in that partnership, right, you are seen as kind of othered. And what I started to see was that that all of these myths we have around and negative connotations around singleness are just simply not true. This idea that singles are somehow lonelier. Well, there's research to show that singles have more social connections than married people. We have good, you know, indications from research that the key to health and happiness is not marriage, it's any kind of relationship, right? Friendships, mentorships, coaches, weak ties, all the different types of variety of relationships. So we have the data to show that we don't need to put all this unnecessary shame and discrimination on singles. So I think it's time for everyone to start thinking about that.
Was it important for you to have all this research and data in the way you approach this book because of how singleness is memorialized, I guess, in our society? You mentioned the tax code, and you're right. Like, you think about how we as a society approach this, but you're coming at this with some real, you know, thoughtful elevation of the wisdom of some scientists, psychologists, and behaviorists, as you say.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a journalist, so I wanted to look at the, you know, what do the experts say, right? That's always kind of my first task. I don't want to just make something up, right? although it's always tempting. But no, I wanted to really use my journalism skills to show people, hey, like, we can actually debunk some of these myths and these ideas around what does it mean to be single and what are some tools that we all could use to like our own company, right? Things that, because I know that loneliness is so, it weighs so heavy on so many people, especially in America. And, you know, to find research that shows, hey, loneliness is not something to feel bad about necessarily. You can actually think of it as a biological signal. There's all this research. It's telling you, hey, go make social connections, right? I feel like that just helps destigmatize things like loneliness, things like, you know, what does it mean to be single, and points to people and feels like, hey, okay, there's actual research and evidence behind this, so I can get behind it too.
Is the book only for single people, or what can people who are in a relationship get out of it?
Sure. My secret hope is that married people get this book and read it. One, because I think it'll help them be happier in their own relationships. I mean, I don't think anyone should stop being their own best partner just because they're in a romantic partnership. Retaining your own personhood, I think, is so important. We all know that, you know, you can only control yourself. You can't depend on other people to, you know, process emotions for you, right? You can get support, and support is wonderful and important, but no one can feel sad for you, right? No one can feel fully happy for you. And then I also hope that, you know, married people get from this book, or anyone in a long-term romantic partnership, how they can maybe treat their single friends differently, right? I write a lot in the book about the harmful things that people say to singles, like, you're too intimidating, you're too picky, or they treat their single friend's life like entertainment, right? Like, tell me about your dating stories. Give me your Tinder profile. I want to look and see what's on there. And so I really hope that married people get from this book, one, advice about how they can be their own person, right, and still be in partnership with someone, but also think about how to, you know, treat their friends who are single kindly and celebrate them and not treat them as like a zoo animal.
And people in relationships can feel lonely in that relationship. You talk a little bit about a solitude style. Can you tell more about that?
Yeah, this is my attempt to kind of make solitude fun. I'm great at solitude, but I know not everyone is. So I wanted to get people to think about how they could find their own flavor of solitude. And so, you know, one idea is to make solitude a time when you always work on a special project. In the pandemic, I love movies and I miss going out to the movie theater. So I would take a trilogy. I would find trilogies I'd never seen before, and make sure I watch all those. And then I had something to talk about with friends, and it became, you know, even though I was in solitude, it became a connection point later. I also recommend doing a creative project as well in your solitude time, right? Things like writing, embroidering, cooking, and then, you know, taking yourself. I know that The Artist's Way, that famous book, talks about this idea of an artist date, you know, taking yourself on dates to get more information and input for your creativity. Or if you just really find yourself itching in your skin about solitude and being alone, stealing a study technique called the Pomodoro Method, where you literally set a timer for 20 minutes and you do something absorbing, and then you take a five-minute break when that timer goes off, and then you start again. The idea being that you will find yourself in such a state of flow, likely, once you're in that solitude state, maybe doing something with your hands, I always recommend, just to keep yourself preoccupied. But then once the timer goes off, you're in that flow state, you think, actually, maybe I don't need that five-minute break anymore, and you can kind of push through. So I recommend solitude styles because I think it's a way to help choose from like a menu, because sometimes I think when people are told, well, just, you know, do something, right? You know, just pick something and enjoy it. You have that paradox of choice problem. You get kind of stuck in thinking, what do I pick? So kind of grouping them into styles, I think, is a helpful way to get started.
You partnered with NPR art director and illustrator Ellie Johnson to illustrate the book. Talk about why this highly visual element is so important to the book.
Yeah, I think what's always so tricky when you're writing is that you're trying to communicate what's in your head right to the page. And I got this wonderful illustrator, L.A. Johnson, to really visualize what was going on in my head. And I think she did a wonderful job. There's just so many images in the book. They're all hand-painted illustrations that then were scanned to go into the book that really show you the frustration that can come with being single. The kind of, there's one where I think where someone's like holding like a big boulder above their head and then eventually she gets to put it down. Right. And I just felt really lucky that LA was able to really tap into a lot of the metaphors in the book, a lot of the feelings, in the book. And it also, and translate into this gorgeous art, but also showing this kind of arc of feeling really frustrated, and you can kind of see it visually, and then ending with this beautiful set of friends and family around you and just having a beautiful life, and you can see it right there on the page.
Megha Keene, the founder and managing producer for NPR's Life Kit, and we've been talking about her book, Party of One, Be Your Own Best Life Partner, illustrated by L.A. Johnson. Thank you so much, and we'll see you at the party.
Yes, thank you, Tim. Appreciate it.
That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Here's to a happy, healthy, and peaceful new year. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Jeff Bank, Sullivan County's community bank, celebrating 110 years of service this year, offering deposit and loan products for all your banking needs. Member FDIC and an equal housing lender. National Mortgage Licensing System and Registry Identification Number 405318. Jeff Bank, still banking strong. And support comes from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, independent grassroots global news. Our reporting includes breaking daily news headlines and in-depth interviews with people on the front lines of the world's most pressing issues. People speaking for themselves, providing unique and sometimes provocative perspectives on global events. Democracy Now!, weekdays at noon, right here on Radio Catskill.
This is Jeff Wofford. Join me each and every Friday, 10 to midnight, as we go deep, playing songs that you don't hear on the radio all the time. It's the Deep End. Deep End. Deep End. Deep cuts and live tracks from the worlds of classics, psych, prog, jam, and blues rock. The Deep End, each and every Friday night from 10 to midnight, right here on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Made possible by listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org. Listen on air, live streaming at WJFFradio.org, or ask your smart speaker to play Radio Catskill.